All right, and welcome everybody. I'm Stephen Roberts, and this is another show with Giving Children Hope with Donna Ferris and Tanis from Manitoba. So, welcome back to the show, ladies, Donna and Tanis.
Hi, thank you very much. Welcome everyone to Giving Children Hope. Welcome Tanis, thank you for being on here as well. We have an exciting show for everyone tonight. We have Connie Valentine and Karen Anderson from California Protective Parents Association. Karen Anderson was the founder, and Connie the co-founder. Also, Courageous Kids Network, which I'm very excited to learn more about tonight through Karen Anderson, the original creator. So welcome, ladies. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Donna. We're happy to be.
Tanis?
Yes, thank you for coming on. I know you two women have been in the trenches of this issue for many, many years, and we're hoping to hear your take on what has been happening over the years in family court in these extreme cases where children are segregated from their mothers, and what do you think is going to be happening in the future?
Would you like me to start out? This is Connie.
Yes, that'd be great, Connie.
Sure. Well, Karen and I met in the late 1990s because both of us had custody cases, and we met with several people who also just sort of appeared on our horizon. Who also had custody cases, because every single one of us sort of felt that we were the only ones in the world. And it was such a relief to meet other people that were going through this and to try to have some kind of coalition to approach it and to see what we could do to fix the problem. So we banded together with a couple of us, and we started California Protective Parents Association. Just as a group, not as anything formal. And we would meet occasionally, you know, around a kitchen table, and would just try to strategize and go to different agencies to try to get help for the mothers who were joining us. More and more of them were joining us. So we would go to the different agencies, and they would just look at us like they were shocked that this had never come to their attention before. So we realized that it was a little bit more difficult than we thought at first. Yeah. So then the husband of a woman who was just tangentially related to one of the women who was meeting with us, he was a part of a nonprofit that needed to give away a certain amount of money, and so he gave us a check for California Protective Parents Association. Well, that was the good and the bad news, because that meant, you know, a little bit of money, but it also meant we had to have a real organization to accept the check. So we got our local domestic violence people to kind of be the fiscal agent for it. And then the next year, which was 1999, we formed a nonprofit ourselves, which has been a good thing, I think, overall, although it's a lot of work to sort of maintain it. And in the beginning, we were just entirely naive. We just looked at each other and said, well, you know, if we go to the legislature, they'll fix it. If we go to the governor, they'll fix it. If we go to the judiciary, they'll fix it. And we were entirely and completely wrong, because they were not at all interested in fixing it.
I might interject here. In 1997, I went back to Washington, D.C. and participated in a press conference for the Department of Justice, and that was the first time I met women from around the country that had the same kinds of cases, and I was just astounded. There were actually 21 women that attended this press conference, and you know, all the cases were just basically boilerplate. You know, you could just substitute different names in. They all had the same chain of events leading to a bad outcome. So the Department of Justice knew this was going on as far back as 1997.
So we're going back, I'm sorry, this is Donna here, Karen. We're going back at least 17 years that you two ladies have been in this battle to protect our children. Can we back up for a second and just kind of briefly explain to anyone who's listening that has not walked into the walls of within the walls of our courtrooms, has not experienced what's actually occurring in our family law courts? Can we just kind of tell them a little bit about that?
Well, basically, what's happened is the family court has become like a business, an industry. And once the mental health professionals got involved with family court, which they didn't used to be years ago, but once they got involved, then everything kind of fell apart. And so what was happening is any time a woman went into court and tried to protect her children or herself from an abusive ex-spouse, she'd end up losing custody to the abuser. And so it's just so counterintuitive that anything like that would happen. But it really was a result of the influence of the mental health industry and the family courts.
And basically, I mean, I think for anyone that's listening to understand, it's if you go into a family law court, a custody court, where you're sent when you're seeking protection for domestic violence or abuse and child abuse, instead of a criminal court. Those are crimes and it should be in a criminal court. You're sent into a family law court to try to protect your children because of some sort of violent episode or something. And as soon as you do, there's a protocol in place, which, Karen, you mentioned, you know, same chain of events with the same bad outcome, the 21 women that you met in 1997, you know,
right,
from all over. So there's a protocol in place. It's a business. It's some sort of industry. And before you know it, your child is gone and is placed into the sole custody of the person abusing you and your children.
Correct.
Right. I wanted to, just for anyone that's listening out there that's new tonight listening, because what we're trying to do with this program is to raise public awareness for those who have not seen what's happening but want to know a little bit more. And that this is, it's so prevalent that it's a pandemic, in fact, throughout our world.
And and the other thing that's unique to these cases is that, you know, without exception, all the people that this happens to are people that are basically middle-class people that have some money and some assets when they go into family court. In other words, I worked as a domestic violence counselor, and I saw cases there where, you know, maybe the mom was on welfare, the dad didn't have a job, you know, nobody had any money in the family, and those cases usually went through the system and, you know, the kids ended up with the parent the safe parent and the primary caregiver parent. But these cases, almost all of them, you know, were a certain subset of custody cases, which were cases that middle-class families were litigating in family court.
That's right. You just said it, too. I wanted to kind of run that by you, Karen. Your experience with what type of parents, because my experience so far in just the limited outreach I've been doing is with a lot of professionals.
Yes.
And, you know, and also I'm not saying anything for, because really it's, it, what I've seen in the state of Maine is it doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter where you come from, unless your family has an enormous amount of money, this protocol can be tapped into place and your child can be taken.
Correct.
Yep. That's how bad
and
this industry is. Oh, go ahead, Connie.
Generally it's the mother who has lesser resources than the father. So that's one of the reasons that the children are moved over to the person who has the highest income, because they can afford the most aggressive attorney. Sometimes in the cases, the mothers don't even have attorneys, and the father has, you know, maybe two. And then they appoint a child's attorney, and that child's attorney usually sides with the more powerful person. So that's one of the dynamics that's really appalling to me, is the lack of due process of the children are basically given to the highest bidder, the person with the most money.
Exactly. And when you stop and think about it, if you go into, well, the U.S. Supreme Court has already made a finding that the custody of your children is a protected liberty interest. And any time you're litigating to protect a liberty interest, you're entitled to due process. And that just doesn't happen in family court when one person's got an attorney and the other person can't afford one. And if you think about it, you know, if your neighbor has a tree and the limb of that tree hangs over the fence into your yard and the limb falls off and falls on your foot and breaks your foot, you can go to court and have a jury trial to determine, you know, if that person's responsible for your medical bills and whatever else came along with it. And that's something that's, you know, so minor. And here you're, when you're in litigating for the custody of your children, which is going to affect those children for the entire rest of their lives,
exactly.
You're not entitled to a jury trial. You're not entitled to representation. I mean, it's, you know, if you get it, you're lucky, but, you know, you're not guaranteed that, even though you're litigating for to protect a liberty interest.
Right. Exactly. My concern is kind of going back to the beginning of what you were saying, Karen. In 1997, the Department of Justice press conference, you know, that's your first experience of really seeing how widespread this is and that they were made aware of it. Where do we stand now? You know, what is it that we can do as a group, as all of us, for all of our children?
Well, there is a movement afoot right now, which is to get congressional oversight hearings. And that, yeah, because each of the states are represented in these terrible problems, these cases that go so wrong. And I have to say that this is a minority of cases. Generally, 85% of the cases go through family court without much of a fuss. And the reason is the parents are both normal people. They, you know, you have two respectful people, or more or less respectful people. 15% or so of the cases go terribly wrong, and those are the ones that have a batterer or a molester as the opponent. And they are cases that are quite different. Family court is not set up at all for taking care of that particular issue. So,
you know, the fathers' rights groups love to say, oh, women always get custody, and 85% of the time they get custody, and they make it sound as if that women have custody because it's been litigated, but that isn't true. Usually when the moms have custody, it's because the parents have agreed for the mother to have custody. You know, they've come to that agreement themselves. These are not the cases that are, you know, litigated in family court. These are the ones that go to mediation and they make an agreement, or maybe they make an agreement without even going to mediation.
Well, and I'd like to add just a little bit to what you were saying, Connie. The 15%, the reason that those don't fit in our family law courts, and the family law courts are not set up to handle them, is because they have a criminal component to them. That is all criminal behavior that needs to be in a criminal court with a criminal judge who is well-trained and experienced in dealing with them. It needs to be taken out of the family law court.
That's right. I mean, child abuse is a crime. Domestic violence is a crime.
Absolutely.
There's no reason that these cases should ever be litigated in family court.
That's right. That's right. And that's my goal with this, with the congressional oversight hearings. That's what I want to see. I want to see this taken out, and I want to see punishment served for all of the criminals that are abusing, beating, torturing, raping, and killing all of our children. Doesn't matter who they are.
The one thing we have to be a little bit concerned about is that there's a very high bar in criminal court, which is you have to prove your case beyond a reasonable doubt. So what's being proposed
just the starting of a proposal is to have a two-tiered criminal court bar. And one is that if there's enough evidence to find the person guilty, that's great. It goes to prosecution. However, there would be another level, which would be, is it the preponderance, the civil preponderance of evidence, which is a lower burden of proof for the child to be protected.
Exactly.
So it's a little bit more complicated than just moving them all over to criminal court, but it's really clearly criminal court should be the one that looks at them, and that the DA should have victim advocates for these children on the taxpayer's dime.
For example, you may have a case where a child is 4 years old and the child discloses that they've been molested by the father or the mother's boyfriend or whoever, and maybe the prosecutor isn't going to take that to criminal court because of the child's age and inability to testify. So at that point, you know, even though that's a criminal matter, you can't just say, well, you know, we took it the criminal route and it's not being prosecuted because of this, and then just abandon it after that. There has to be something that follows it that will protect the child, and that's where the second tier would come in, where you would be looking at the situation from the preponderance of evidence burden of proof, which is just more likely than not.
Exactly. I gotta share that years ago when I was working as a guardian ad litem here in the state of Maine, if we had a case where a criminal element came into it, and in any type of case that involved a child, and it came into the family law court, say I was a guardian ad litem on a custody case and in sexual abuse, evidence of sexual abuse came to light, it was immediately taken out of the custody court and brought over to the criminal court to be investigated, hearing, and all that. The only part that remained in the custody court at the time was the fact that parent, whether it was the mother or the father, their rights were terminated. You know, there wasn't anything. It took the child and the child's life and the child's safety out of the custody court and protected it completely in the criminal court. The only thing that was left was to follow up with the safety and ensure, further safety through the parent, the safe parent. And that's just,
well, see, but you're talking about two different things, because in a lot of states, family court, there is no provision to terminate parental rights in family court. That's done in dependency court. So some states have family court and dependency court and criminal court and civil court and probate court and all that. Some states combine, apparently, family court and dependency court. So what happens in family court is they take the safe parent and they do de facto terminations of parental rights of the protective parent by giving the perpetrating parent sole physical and sole legal custody, so that the protective parent has, and then, you know, not affording them any visitation. And for all intents and purposes, they have terminated parental rights, but without any of the due process protections that goes along with a formal termination of parental rights the way it's done in dependency court.
My goodness. It's just they've got it so chaotic and confusing among so many states and countries that no one knows what's, well. It makes the silencing worse for all of our children.
I would like to say that is very, very well explained. Both Karen and Connie, you've explained this so well. And you know, as I'm listening, the question arises, this is obviously deliberate. If they've known about this and these are very intelligent people that are making legislation and laws and enforcing them, why have they done nothing about this?
Well, the problem with the federal government is that they always say they need a federal latch, and this is a state issue. So the states can pretty much get away with whatever they want to do in their courtrooms until the feds you know, understand the federal latch and start doing something about it on the federal level. And there are, when you're talking about constitutional due process, that there's your federal latch right there. And freedom of speech, like protective parents are ordered in family court not to speak to their child about abuse. I mean, that happens frequently in these kinds of cases.
Yep.
That's an issue of violation of free speech. In other words, if the child continues to tell you something about abuse, you're not, by court order, you're not allowed to respond to them about it.
That's right.
And I believe you're right. It's deliberate. We've known about in the United States, Tanis, we've known about this, the Temporary Aid to Needy Families Act that passed in, I think, about 1997, which had a money rider for healthy marriage promotion and responsible fatherhood. To the tune of $150 million per year. So ever since the late 90s, there's been this enormous amount of money being pumped into the states from the federal government that gives money to promoting fatherhood and promoting healthy marriage. But they, you know, I don't know what happens with that particularly, but promoting fatherhood, some of it can go by law to advertising campaigns for fathers. And so when you look at the television and the movies and the website, the fatherhood website on our Department of Health and Human Services, you would really think that men bear children and give birth to them. There's no mention of any woman involved at all. Mothers are excised from the picture. If you look at the advertisements, you see men pushing baby carriages and men carrying the babies. And you see it on the streets. The woman is walking 20 paces behind. The man is probably carrying the child in front. I mean, one could look at that and say, it looks like, you know, fathers are finally pitching in. But really, it's a very deliberate, financed, highly financed with our taxpayer dollars advertising campaign. That's not helping things.
It was originally promoted as, we feel that fathers would be more likely to pay child support. In other words, it's costing the states all this money for mothers to be on welfare because fathers aren't paying child support. And we think that fathers would pay child support if they had a better relationship with their children. And so basically, in fact, I know an attorney who was on the bottom floor of the legislation in California who spoke to me about this issue where they linked child custody time share to child support allotments. In other words, how much you paid in support was dependent on how much contact you had with the child. And she said that they did that deliberately to basically bribe fathers to spend time with their children, hoping that that would cause them to pay more child support. And she said, we wondered at the time if that was a good idea. Now we know it was a complete disaster.
Like
so they promoted it from that, you know, that's how their public promotion was. Well, we're going to have, you know, fathers more involved because that way they'll pay more child support and the burden, there won't be so much burden on the taxpayers of the states in welfare payments. But there was a certain amount of people involved in this that was never their intention. It's apparent. Their intention was to, promote fatherhood as a, you know, put fathers on a pedestal as gods, as part of patriarchy.
And then there's the other piece where what has become increasingly obvious, rather than changing, the children who disclose sexual abuse end up in the sole custody of their identified abuser.
Right.
Correct. And they do that so they can silence the child.
It's really witness, victim-witness tampering. If a victim-witness
starts to talk, and they get put into the, you know, the room with their abuser, they're not going to talk after that. So it's a very clever perpetrator methodology to silence the witnesses, to gag the children. And it does a very good job, and it sometimes they become Stockholm syndromed and end up preferring the abusive parent to the safe parent, which is the biggest tragedy I've ever seen.
I mean, if you stopped and thought about it in the criminal context and imagined what would happen if you took a rape victim and forced them to live with their rapist, you know, obviously what would happen to that person? They'd be scared out of their mind, and they would have no source of safety, and that's what happens to these kids. I mean, they would never do something like that in a criminal court, but in family court, it's routine.
Right, and then what happens, you know, year after year in our society, in our generation, what happens to our children through this fear and the terror and the brainwashing, the manipulation and the prison and the silencing? You know, they're in our community, they're in society, and, you know, this is just so devastating on so many levels. I mean, we're not talking just a couple kids here and there. We're talking, you know, Connie, when we were in D.C. in October, this past October, I mean, how many parents were there, you know, that stood up and talked about their custody cases all over?
That's right. And the Leadership Council did a very clever analysis of how many children, they were trying to estimate how many children are removed from their safe parents and put in the full or partial custody of their batterers and molesters. They came up with a number of 58,000 children per year. So in the last 20 years, that means a million children have been placed with their batterers and molesters after they've revealed that they're being hurt. This is appalling, and this is a cohort of children who is growing up and will strike out because the anger, you know, first there's fear when they're living with the abuser, but then they grow up and they either have depression because their anger is turned inward or their anger is turned outward into society. And I don't for a moment think that it's going to be a peaceful society with that kind of group of children growing up. We've already seen all the shooters. We don't know what happened in their lives, but, you know, I could just about guess.
Right. And at this point, with so many abusers, criminals, you know, out, you know, in society hiding under the guise of a parent because they were given sole custody from a court, you know, look at the danger to society. People have no idea, really. You know, and that's what this show is about. And I thank you guys again for coming on. I really want to get to Karen. You started the Courageous Kids Network, and I want to kind of talk about that. Would you mind kind of sharing with us the mission and the philosophy?
Well, basically, it was designed to give children who had been through these terrible custody cases and had rescued themselves, because the only kids we ever saw got rescued were the kids who took it upon themselves to get rescued, which was usually running away.
Yeah.
And it was a way to give them a voice, because they were so frustrated, and, you know, they wanted to do whatever they could do to change it for other kids so they wouldn't have to go through what they did. And it's like every victim, when a victim finally gets safe, they have a need to talk about their experience. And these kids didn't have any place to do that. They didn't have other kids they didn't know other kids that had similar experiences, so they felt very alone. This gave them an opportunity to meet other kids that had endured the same thing, and so they didn't feel quite so alone.
It's unbelievable. And these are children that reach out to all other children as well, right?
Right.
Wow, it's just amazing. That's, you know, to give them a voice that they need, you know, because like we were saying, they're in prison, basically, with the forced silencing, and they have no idea what the loving parent is trying to do, the protective parent, they have no idea. They're not at the court hearings. They're not reading the court orders. They don't know that the other parent might still be screaming, you know, for their lives and for their safety, so that for year after year after year, you know, locked in that abuse and silence in prison, when they finally do break free, I do believe that this is, you know, such an avenue for them. They need to know that they're not alone.
Well, and the abusers tell them that their safe parent didn't want them, you know, and they lie about the safe parent. They, you know, they just fill their heads full of garbage. And, you know, so in addition to being isolated from the truth, you know, they don't know that anybody else has ever gone through this, because they're so isolated from, usually the abuser will even monitor all their internet activity, not allow them to email certain people, go over to people's houses, anything that the abuser feels might be a threat to him, you know, they're prevented from doing. So they're really pretty isolated from the outside world, and they didn't ever have an opportunity to know that they're not the only one in the world that this has happened to.
That's right.
I'd like to interject, Karen, just if you could make a connection for the listeners, having a background in domestic violence, how similar these custody orders are for the children and youth right up until they're 18, being held there by a custody order. Part of the intimidation and bullying is the custody order. Well, the judge said, this is the way it's going to be till you're 18. And just as women, you know, people will often say, oh, well, if there's something happening and they're 14, well, they can leave. They have a say. Or, oh, if they're 16, they can get out of there. They can emancipate themselves. Just like women who stayed in marriages and were told, even if the marriage involved abuse, well, stay and make it work out because of the legal marriage license before the domestic violence movement. How this is a replication of the same dynamics, but
it's
children.
It's exactly the same dynamic. Threats are made, and they don't have to be verbal threats. Children, you know, an abuser is scary. They are afraid of that person's anger. And so they can be threatened just by being living in that household. Even if the abuser isn't making verbal threats, you know, I'll kill your pet, I'll kill your mother, I'll kill whatever, you know, they don't have to make any verbal threats to intimidate the child. Just like with an adult victim of domestic violence, the victim is so afraid of the abuser's anger that they just placate them because they don't know what they're going to do. They've seen them do things that are violent. They've seen the extent that they would go to control them, and they're afraid to test them. So it's exactly the same dynamic as with an adult victim of domestic violence. And with the women who are victims of domestic violence, a lot of times the abuser threatens, if you leave, I'll take the kids. I'll get custody of the kids, and you'll never see them again.
And that threat's born out to be true in
yes.
ever since the 90s,
yes.
if not the 80s.
Yes, exactly.
So is there anything that the young people that are coming out of this, or you women who've been in this and aware of this and working and fighting for justice for these children the last almost 20 years, is there anything, any message to those that are in this situation right now? Like, do these children have any way out when these custody orders are enforced until they're 18? Like, the children are a piece of property.
They are treated as a piece of property. And, you know, some of them have been successful by, like I said, the ones that we know have been successful, they've all just run away, you know, and refused to go back to the abuser or hidden out. Very few have been successful using the legal system. Hopefully, that can change, at least in California, because now we have a statute that says, you know, if a child wants to personally address the court has got to hear the child. But, of course, that's for 14 and older. First of all, if you have a parent that's unrepresented, they don't know that that law exists, so the child might not know that they have a legal opportunity to address the court themselves. And the judge does still have the option of saying, no, I won't hear from the child, because the law gave them a loophole where they could still deny hearing from the child, but they have to put in writing what their reasoning is, which is supposed to supposedly make it a little bit more difficult for them to deny that.
There's far too much judicial discretion. Far, far too much.
Yeah, every time you get a really good law, you know, initiated, it ends up getting watered down to where it's almost useless.
That's right.
Yeah, what is the point of the laws if they don't enforce them, or, I mean, follow them themselves? The good laws, the Constitution. We have a Constitution that has, you know, that is to protect children's and adults and women's interest, and it's not either. It's not followed by these people that are to uphold the Constitution.
Well, you would think there was no Constitution after sitting in family court.
That's
because
right.
They act like there isn't one.
That's right. It's the same in Canada and in the UK and in Australia and Europe.
Karen, would you tell them about the project that you're working on that is at least one tiny little piece of accountability that we understand is very useful, according to a judge, very useful in keeping judges accountable?
It's a project where volunteers go into the courtroom and fill out an observation form to monitor hearings, and it's random. The volunteers are assigned randomly to family courtrooms, and then they fill out an observation form, and the data is collected, and then eventually the data will be able to be analyzed for you know, certain trends. But I can tell you from what we haven't gotten to the part where the data can be analyzed yet. We're working on getting a new program specifically for this project that will do that. But in reviewing the observation forms, I mean, some things just stand out. Some of the due process violations stand out, which is like the one that's most obvious, is that there's no court reporters for these hearings. So people who get a bad outcome don't even have an opportunity to appeal a bad order because they don't have a record of the proceedings.
And all of these processes take time to bring about any change, and there's children continuing to basically be at risk and dangle in danger.
But yeah, and that's the other thing. The only way to correct a bad order is to appeal it. And the appeal process, even if they, you know, a custody appeal, usually you can get put on an expedited basis, but expedited to them is like a year and a half instead of 3 years or whatever. It still takes forever, and the damage is all being done to the child in the meantime. And then, even if you win the appeal goes back to the same judge who made the bad decision. Now, there is, in California anyway, there's a provision where you can get rid of a judge who's been overturned on appeal. But once again, you have to know that that law exists. And if you don't have legal representation, you're not even going to know you can do that. And probably it's not going to make a difference anyway, because they'll assign somebody who will do the, you know, follow the same format as the person before them, usually. Not always, but usually.
Connie, did you want to add something?
Well, the due process, we did, when we first started out, we started collecting data from, and I know this isn't, you know, it's not an exciting part of the whole project, but we started collecting data from mothers and, or from protective parents, but they were 99% mothers who responded. So the data has been very helpful in quantifying what's going on. And one of the things that I've noticed, we had about 400 cases now, which is, you know, sounds like a small number compared to 58,000 kids. But it's these are the women who were brave enough to fill out the form and found it and all that. So, and apparently it's 400 cases. That's, even if you got 5,000 cases, the data would be practically the same. So we're pretty comfortable with this information. And what happens is that in like 80% of the cases, the mother started out with primary custody, and the child started talking about being abused. So everything was going along fine until there was this child abuse revelation of some sort, physical or sexual. And most of the children positively identified the father, like 3/4 of them. Well, what happened was, is it started out with 80% of mothers with primary custody, and at the end of the, I call it the fleecing process, because again, these are middle-class women, middle to upper-class couples, I guess. At the end of the process, only 25% had primary custody because they raised the issue of child abuse. That was the only thing that happened. That was the difference. They started out with custody, they ended up with no custody because they raised the issue of abuse. And there were so many due process violations that were documented in this. 65% of the transcripts were denied or delayed. 72% of the fathers were represented by an attorney when the mother had no attorney. 3/4 of the cases. Now, they well may be all the same cases in which the mother lost custody. So there are all these things that the government can do and should do, such as provide transcripts, such as provide attorneys, to even the playing field. And the problem with the entire mess is that the mothers stop reporting that their children are being abused, but the children don't stop reporting. They keep telling people. But 2/3 of the children continue to report abuse to their teachers, to CPS, to whoever. And what ends up is that they are completely marginalized because the very beginning person decided he or she did not believe them. And so it's a, you know, stripping custody because women and children are not being believed. Now, this can all be reversed. This can be reversed. I feel completely confident of it. And I believe that the children, you know, the courageous kids, are going to be the ones who will be able to do that because the mothers are marginalized. They have no attorney. They have no credibility. Some of them don't have as important a job category as the fathers. They certainly don't have the aggressive attorney. But the children are the ones that, were we to focus on them, and the name of your program is so wonderful, Giving Children Hope. The hope is that the children will grow up to somehow or another begin to help impact the legislature, the Congress, etc. And I can tell you that the law that we got passed to give children voices when they were 14, it was because two courageous kids went to the legislature and spoke to the domestic violence group there so eloquently that the head of that group said, I will take this bill forward. So that's what the children can do. These were 14-year-old kids who spoke so beautifully and so articulately that it made everyone in the audience cry. I mean, I don't think there was a dry eye in the whole room.
There was another group, a family law task force, that was, because of some horrendous case, in California. And we brought lots and lots of mothers and fathers to say, you know, the court system is going very badly. But the person that was listened to most was one young man who just turned 18, who went and spoke bravely. I mean, he's a wonderful kid. Spoke at this big, in this big audience to this circular group of people who were looking to the family court. And the chief, the head of the group that was the task force said, well, you know, wouldn't it be difficult for children to talk to judges? And this child reared back in his chair and he said, not
have. Or to testify.
To speak to judges in any fashion. And he sort of reared back in his chair and he said, not half as hard as living with a pedophile for 13 years. And that just silenced all of the opposition. There was just no way anyone could overturn that personal testimony.
Look how powerful our children are.
They are so powerful. They have no idea. And I hope some of them are listening now.
I hope so, too.
It's going to be their world, and they're going to make a better world of it.
Amen.
I completely agree with you, Connie. The hope is with the youth and the children that are becoming youth in a few short years. The ones that have just aged out, young people like Jennifer Collins and her brother and Damon and the young fellow that 17 that was just interviewed on this show with Stephen last week.
Yeah.
These children that have become young adults or older youth are the hope for the children that are still in this situation, to give a voice to the ones that have been silenced. And I was thinking as I was listening to what you, Karen and Connie, you were both saying, is what if we got this information, and what if the young people got this information out to the schools? So it opened up forums for those children in these custody orders that are a form of legalized abuse or legal abuse, and had those children starting to come forward and talking, because right now there's no voice for them. The mainstream media does not cover these cases ever. The odd time it has happened, these children feel, if they are to come forward and talk to school counselors or anybody, like you said, Connie, that people won't believe them. But if it became...
Right.
It's the naming of it, like the domestic violence education. It's the naming of it and then disseminating that information. So those that, just like sexual abuse survivors of third party, like sports in the Catholic Church, once some started coming forward, more and more came forward. So somehow... to get this information that there are a certain percentage of children in these custody cases where they are not safe, where they are being harmed.
We had wonderfully, just miraculously, in October of last year, we had a congressional briefing, not an oversight hearing, that's what we're angling for, but a briefing, which is where professionals or experts come and speak to the congressional aides and educate them on various topics. Well, this one was on abused children of divorce, how to protect them. And so we're starting to develop a name for this cohort, which is children of divorce, of which a certain percentage are abused. And if we were to, in schools, if we were to have a movement in schools of, you know, groups of children of divorce, you know, maybe like they have children of alcoholics groups, maybe a lot of crossover there too, it would be a fabulous thing to just meet the needs of those children as children of divorce, because 50% of the children are experiencing divorce, and all of divorce is a trauma to children. That's one of the items on the adverse childhood experiences study list. There are only 10 things that really affect children. And one of them is divorce or loss of a parent. And that is considered a very high stress issue for a child. So it would be good for schools to develop programs for this particular group. I don't know how we would do it or who would head it up, but it's a great idea.
Yes, exactly. I agree.
I think it's the youth that could put together the most a program that could go viral and be picked up by the school. So the concept could go viral via social media, and then different little cell groups in the schools of the students could actually start it.
And
if we wait till the education system, you know, rolls around with, you know, changing some policy, it can be years. Whereas the youth have the means through social media to just make things go viral and
to make things happen fast.
Make things happen fast. That's right. That's right, Karen.
They're geared for speed.
That's right.
Wired
and when
for
you
speed.
When you think
well,
about it.
Well, I know,
it,
you know, the church that I go to has a divorce care group, and they have a group for children, too. While the parents are in the divorce care group, the children have a group of their own. And that's something new, and I'm not aware of that anywhere else.
Wow, that is great. That's wonderful that, you know, your church is stepping up to do something about this issue. I wanted to ask you guys if you thought maybe I'd like to have you, Karen and Connie, talk about how if there's any children listening to the show, either tonight or once it comes out on MP3, how would they connect with the Courageous Kids Network? And then maybe we could go to a short break before coming back to some questions from the chat room.
Well, Jennifer Collins is the one who is, you know, monitoring the Courageous Kids now. And they go to the website.
Okay.
The website is courageouskids.net.
Okay, I'm going to put that in the chat room too. Courageouskids.net.
Right.
And this is for, you know, any child out there looking to get in touch and connect, maybe, you know, talk with others who've been where they are. You know, that would give them a little hope and know that they're not alone. This is a wonderful, wonderful program. And I thank Jennifer Collins, too, for taking this on. And I'd love to have her on the show sometime soon. Really would. Stephen, what do you think about taking a short break?
Sure. I could put about a 4.5-minute thing in there if you want.
Does that sound good with you ladies, too?
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, great. So we'll come back in 4.5 minutes. Thank you so much.
All right.
Okay.
All right, and welcome back, everybody. We're back from a little short break there. Donna and Tandis are back with me, as well as, I'm sorry, forgive me with the other two ladies' names again.
Connie and Karen.
Connie and Karen, okay. Go ahead, Donna.
Well, welcome back, everyone. And at this time, we would take any questions in the chat room for Connie Valentine and Karen Anderson. Anything about the Courageous Kids Network, you know, just shoot any questions our way. In the meantime, Tanis, you just asked a perfect question of Connie and Karen about, you know, the success. Like, let's talk about what children can do. What are some options they have? You know, what are some things that are going on right now that lots of folks are trying to do on behalf of children?
That's right. We know that the things that children are told in school aren't working for these kids, like go tell a counselor, go tell a trusted adult if you're being abused. When you have custody orders in place that are enforced until they're 18, and all government employees, enforce those custody orders over helping a child, such as the police, child protective workers, teachers, medical doctors. So the children know that after being so betrayed, if they did disclose abuse, and then they get put where they don't feel safe, where are they to go? What are they to do? They're told these orders are in place till they're 18. So that's more the question I raised.
I wish we had answers for that question.
Well, what worked for one boy was that he ran away, and then when he was underground for a couple of years, just couch hopping and educating himself while he was away. But when he got to be 16, he hired an attorney of his own. Now, he had a court-appointed attorney, but that attorney betrayed him and, you know, advocated for him to be with the person that he wasn't safe with. And fortunately for him, that attorney got promoted to a judge and got off of his case. And when he didn't have a court-appointed attorney anymore, he actually hired a private attorney to go into court and fight for his, you know, his right to be safe and to be where he wanted to be. And ultimately, he was successful that way. But of course, to do that, a child would have to find an attorney who was willing to do that and be paid at a later date or whatever, because they're not going to have money to do that, or find some kind of, you know, legal aid or something somewhere where they could get an attorney of their own who would actually represent them.
Another successful situation was two girls had run away. They were 14 and 15. And they found a person who would become their legal guardian. The father had a terrible rap sheet of all sorts of criminal activities. So they became the ward of another person, not their mother, in another part of the state. Went to court and got a temporary order to be with the person that they requested to be with. It's a little bit tricky again, because if the parent who wants custody contests it, then they might be turned right back to him. But in this particular case, the parent who wanted custody was completely drunk and didn't come to the hearing. So, you know, these are desperate measures, but there are some that have been successful. And then there are very interesting situations in which the children have reported, they get put with a perpetrator, and then the perpetrator perpetrates on one of their friends, and the friend's parents go and get him arrested. Yep. And then the child is put back with the safe parent. That's a terrible outcome because the friend got hurt. But they do end up, you know, back with the safe parent. That's a certain number of cases. Joy Silberg of the Leadership Council has documented those. And then there's
those are pretty rare situations.
Totally.
For the most part, you know, the only thing the kids can do really is, that we've seen anyway, is to run away and just absolutely refuse to go back and continue to run away. That's really the only thing that's rescued most of them. And eventually they just give up trying to, you know, put them back with the perpetrator.
Right.
That's a horrible life for the child. You know, sometimes they end up in a group home or, you know, and foster care or whatever, but you know, they seem to think that that's, and I'm sure it is, better than being with someone who's abusing them or has abused them, and they're dealing with all the psychological damage of that.
And I think it's really important to qualify this with the fact that in these cases, they have mothers who are fighting to have these children back, to be reunited with these children, and doing everything possible in the only system that that the mothers are allowed to access, and that's the legal system. And so
right.
these children
and the
could
kids
just
are,
go back to the mothers.
The kids are afraid to go back to their mothers because they're afraid of the repercussions to their mothers. Not just to them, but to their mothers.
Because they've
but
been
the
told what,
been
Karen?
Put in jail.
That's
yeah,
right.
Mothers are put in jail.
Yep. That's what
but
they told my son. I just, sorry, wanted to add, and that's what they told my sons, that if they didn't go with them to their father's sole custody, they were going to arrest me.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's
so,
what they
and, you know, they have a, they want to protect their moms, so, you know, they don't want to do something that's going to make it, make life worse for their mothers either.
Right. I just want to stop for a second and just recognize just how courageous these children are. All of them, you know, the children that we've even talked about tonight, you know, that have taken upon themselves to try to escape the violence, knowing that they have had hope, you know, they're trying. They know right from wrong. They know who loves them. They're running to, they're trying to find, you know, that parent. They're trying to escape the abuse. They're the true heroes in all of this. The children that went and talked in front of the legislature, that takes courage. I don't care what anyone says. I remember being, you know, that age and even having to stand in front of the class to give a speech, let alone go to a legislature and talk about horrid abuse and trauma and try to make change in the state. I just want to recognize
It takes amazing courage when you consider how many adult victims of domestic violence don't have that courage. And you're talking about kids who
exactly.
many times have been abused far worse than the domestic violence victims. And, you know... It's just amazing. It's incredible that they have that courage.
Or the courage just to survive. I would like to add all the children that are not able to get out, not able to run, don't feel that there's any alternatives, just surviving and being that resilient to keep going to school and to keep managing and looking like... everything's okay and normal, and that's one of the things for these poor kids, especially if they're intelligent, which a lot of these kids are, very intelligent, very capable, that that's even used, you know, if they're doing well in school, oh, well, then they're fine. No, they're not.
Yeah.
Emotionally,
yeah.
they're being harmed and damaged, even if the abuse isn't continuing that they disclosed when they were little, to segregate them from family they love. Their mothers and maternal family is cruel, inhumane, and a form of genocide. This is emotional destruction. And for these children to be surviving that is amazing. They're courageous no matter what they do, whether they get away or whether they end up just staying and surviving. It's quite a testament to their strength.
It is. It truly is.
One of the things that I've sort of thought about is how important it is for a child to have some contact with their mom, or their safe parent, you know, which is generally moms in this case, even if it's under this onus of supervised visits, which is obscene on its face. But it still allows them a little bit of contact, and I think that keeps their hope alive. So, you know, advice I give to mothers is be sure and take advantage of every little moment you can have with a child and be exceptionally nice to everybody because they're all taking notes on you. And so it's very, very difficult for the child to have to, you know, interact in such a ridiculous method, but I think it does keep their hope alive. I think that's really important.
I think that's very important, Connie. The whole thing is it's the lesser of two evils, in a sense, because it's so cruel to make children see the parent they felt safe and secure with under those conditions. For years, there's no freedom of expression, no freedom of. There's just it's not natural, but it is better than nothing, than no contact.
Do you remember seeing that movie about Dumbo? And there was a little clip of Dumbo's mother, who was the little elephant's mother, who was in the cage with the bars,
and she put her trunk out and then rocked little Dumbo in her trunk, even though she was imprisoned. And that, to me, is the picture of what's going on now. You know, the mother...
That's a perfect picture.
It's a perfect picture.
It's so right on. It is just so right on. You know, she was jailed because she was protecting her little baby.
Right.
It just brings tears to my eyes. And I think the children, you know, that see their mothers under supervision, they do understand that, but they also see that their mothers are being criminalized, treated like a criminal. And my son cried out when he was 15, you're treating my mother like a criminal. She's not a criminal. She's my mom. She's our mom.
Oh.
And this was right before Christmas, when they wouldn't allow me to give my little boy a recorded book so he would hear my voice reading him the story, because he was taken from me the week after he turned 7. And all three of my children were very traumatized, and there's been a mixture of supervised visits and no contact, and both are damaging for the children, but the supervised visits are better than nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is one of the traps for mothers in and of itself, because you can't, if you want to maintain your small supervised visits, you can't really put your head over the trenches and become an activist, which you really want to be, because then they have this power over you of cutting off the supervised visits. So everything is now delayed for probably a decade until those mothers have their children become 18, and then they can become activists.
Yeah, basically what they do is any kind of activism is reframed by the family court as harmful to your child and abusive towards your child,
right?
Emotionally abusive towards your child. And then, you know, you're punished for that with more restricted contact or no contact.
Yes.
And it's just a way to silence everybody. It's just a way for the court to protect itself.
Right. Any form of speaking out is actually mm-hmm. seen as emotionally harmful to the child, when the opposite is true. Like in everything in these cases, the opposite is what the truth is. So maybe we want to make a comment here, Connie, about what some of the women have chosen to do over these years that have found themselves in this trap. Some have used pen names, hidden their identity in any way. Others are speaking very publicly out on social media and Facebook, like Donna. You know, there's the wide spectrum. And can you say anything about that? Why women are feeling, you know, it's such a catch-22 no matter what we do?
That's interesting you use that term. Under a pseudonym, I wrote an article called Catch-22 when I was in the middle of this. And a pseudonym, a pen name, a different email, that's really important if you're going to be doing anything that the court considers an attack, because, boy, will they retaliate. Now, you've seen that. So, but some of the mothers are actually joining us in Washington, D.C., because every Mother's Day, almost every Mother's Day for the last 4 years, we have gone to Washington, D.C. to demonstrate in front of the White House. And some of the mothers will come and will wear scarves over their faces so that they cannot be recognized. And they demonstrate with us in that manner, and that is a very, you know, that's relatively safe. Or some of them wear those medical masks and dark glasses or something that will, you know, or a wig or something that will make them not identifiable. So, you know, I want to encourage the mothers that want to do that, and we're going to do it again this coming Mother's Day, to consider doing, you know, doing their activism in that manner. Because until we impact the White House and the Congress, we're not going to get a grip on the judiciary. And we are having a lobbying day at Congress. We are going to do everything we can to have another congressional briefing. They've agreed to show part or all of No Way Out But One, which is the Collins story of getting refuge in the Netherlands. They got asylum in the Netherlands from the United States. And the Netherlands was shocked that people were fleeing the U.S. like they were fleeing Somalia. But they did get protected there, and those children are quite outspoken now. So we're hoping to show that film to Congress during one of the briefings. So we've got all kinds of things that we're doing. We want to make a little pitch for signing the petition, which is asking for congressional oversight hearings, which is more on the due process and the financial part. We're hoping to put that in front of Congress because they don't, saying this is an enormous waste of taxpayer dollars, not to mention it's human rights violations of all these children. So the petition you can find on either stopabusecampaign.com or centerforjudicialexcellence.org. The petition is very important because that is going to give us the traction to say, look, there are all these people who are upset about this problem. And, we need thousands and thousands of them. A lot of the children have come actually to the marches in Washington, and they've had a wonderful, empowering time because they get to speak out on a megaphone. That's been great. So we're doing everything we can think of to protect them in various ways. We have not succeeded, and it's very disturbing to me that we have been unable to succeed, even with a great group of bright women who've put their entire energy and time and efforts into. It makes me realize, as you started out with, Donna, that this is deliberate. There's no two ways about it. It's a deliberate tearing the attachment of a child from his or her mother and placing them with a batter. That's a double wound, a double wound.
That's right. And I think, that's an accurate assessment. So far, there has been no solutions. And it's appalling that children are treated like this until they're 18, when there's other laws. If they commit a crime in Canada at 12, they're considered criminally responsible. They're considered able to know what they're doing, to be treated like, it's still juvenile laws, but nevertheless, they're considered to know what they're doing. Sex education in schools is encouraging children to be thinking about their sexuality, whether they're bisexual or gay, transgender, when they're in elementary school. How would a child know that if they can't know where they feel safe and comfortable in their home and have no say about that?
Well, it defies logic, obviously. All of this does, because what's happening to these kids is not logical in any way, shape, or form. It's completely illogical. So it has to be, you can't think that these people who have law degrees, they have to have a certain amount of intelligence to have a law degree. And it's hard to imagine that they are so stupid that they can't realize that. So that only leaves one. What's the alternative? That it's deliberate.
Right. Well, and there's so much money sloshing around that you can understand why it's deliberate, because everybody's getting a little piece of the assets that the couple starts out with. And it turns out in our research that the average mother spends $100,000 on litigation. Who knows how much the average father spends? Maybe twice that. Where does that money go? Well, it goes into the pockets of the attorneys and the pockets of the evaluators and the pockets of the attorneys for the minor.
Co-parenting coordinators and the mediators and the, there was a cartoon that really portrayed it perfectly, and it was a little boy who was hunched over with this huge piece of plywood resting on his shoulders and back. And on top of this plywood, there was a judge, an attorney for the minors, a co-parenting coordinator, a mediator, and all these different family court personnel. And he looked up and he said, "Mommy, why do I have to support all these people?" And I mean, it just, that cartoon says it all. You know, it's become this multi-billion dollar industry where everybody's making money. Yeah. And the only way for them to make money is for the cases to be, you know, litigated. So there's a financial incentive for them to end up with bad outcomes where people are going to continue litigating because that continues the flow of money.
Exactly, and all over the world. I mean, I'm talking, I've met mothers and fathers in Australia. Argentina has a huge group, activist group. There, children in Canada, Tanis, South Africa, that we've got all over the United States. This is Connie we saw in Washington, D.C. in October. It's just, it's an organized crime ring that is fully benefiting off of money, regardless of anybody's life in it, especially our children. I wanted to kind of back up a second, Connie. The Mothers of Lost Children, I know there's already the planned event coming up in May, surrounding Mother's Day weekend. I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about that for, you know, any children that are listening, because I got to say, I was there in D.C. this past October. I was in the briefing, the congressional briefing, and I witnessed how powerful all of our testimonies were, all the parents, the mothers that were there. And I think it would just be incredible for me to hear children. So if we could talk about this a little bit, tell them what to expect, and if there's any way we can get children to the Mother's Day weekend event in D.C., to even speak at the congressional briefing, that would be wonderful. But I think to ease any fears any children would have, we can kind of explain what this event is like and what happens when we go to D.C.
Oh, I will. The plans for this year, this May, is on Friday before Mother's Day, we're going to have a training at George Washington University for advocates and attorneys and anyone else who wants to come, mothers, children, whoever would like to come. Last year we had one, and there were three or four different children, one of whom came up to me and said, "You may not remember me, but you gave me a Courageous Kid medal some years ago," and she was all grown up now. She said, "That meant the world to me." We give Courageous Kids medals on blue ribbons, they're beautiful, to the children who managed to survive this horror.
And what day is that? What, the Friday?
That's Friday the 9th of May. Okay. And that is for advocates and attorneys focused, but it's also mothers and children are more than welcome. Then on Saturday, and we'll put information out in newsletter. If you don't receive a newsletter, please contact me at cppa001@aol.com, and I'll put you on our newsletter list, which will have more information. But then the next day, we're going to have a full day with Joy Silberg being the keynote person. Barry Goldstein will be doing the advocates and attorneys training, but Joy Silberg will do a keynote talk on, we haven't quite named it yet, but Mothering Under Duress, I think is what might be the name of it. How to best mother your child. And I think we really are going to want to have a child speak about what was helpful for that child in this war that was going on. So, and we're going to have mothers provide information on what they did to mother under duress. I mean, one mother called and said, "I can only mother my child through prayer." That was all she had.
and she felt it was effective. You know, it's as effective as it could be. So there are, you know, there are lots of things. And then when the children come home, after they've been in this prisoner of war camp, as one young man calls it, they need a lot of assistance because they are kind of sometimes a wreck. Some of them come out, you know, some children are able to kind of withstand it if the abuse isn't horrendous. But if the abuse is horrendous, then a lot is needed. A lot of good therapy and sometimes, you know, whatever. So we want to kind of bring out all those topics in that day on Saturday, the 10th of May. So that's just a regular conferency thing. And then on Sunday, Mother's Day on the 11th, we all meet up in front of the White House, and we have a speak out right in front of the White House. So far, no one's come out to bother us, and no one's come out to invite us in. So either we have not been hauled off to jail yet, but nobody's paid too much attention to us. I know that it's effective. I know this is effective. I've heard from insider people that they don't like all these women in white T-shirts and white clothes appearing in front of their doorstep. That's not okay. So there's been some action behind the scenes. So it's well worth it. And then we march around the White House as many times as we can manage. You know, we're working up to the biblical seven, but we haven't gotten there yet. So that, and we have great big banners, and we have we bring white T-shirts, and we'll have some there for people. And we have a speak out on the megaphone. So that's Sunday. And then on Monday, we're hoping to have the congressional briefing. I can't promise it because we don't have it for sure yet. But it's in the Congress. It's in one of the rooms in Congress that we would tell you about. And it's just a big room. And then it's got people sitting up at a desk, you know, at giving a talk. And that will be the briefing. And then in the audience are the congressional aides. So it's just like a little mini conference there. And then afterwards, we go around and we lobby. Oops, a lot of noise. We lobby various congressmen or congresswomen to identify, and we try to talk to their congressional aides. So that's what the days will be like, and it's very exciting and wonderful unity, don't you think, Donna?
Yes, that's kind of what I was feeling. This was my first time, not my first time to Washington, D.C., because I did go in eighth grade on my field trip, but it was my first time being there and actually lobbying and standing in front of the White House. That was an experience of itself. And then, yeah, the bullhorn, once you handed that to me, I had fun with that, both in front of the White House and then when we got over to the Capitol Hill. That was even a lot more fun there. I just think this would be wonderful if we could get children, you know, children of divorce or however you're calling it, even the courageous kids, from the Courageous Kids Network, to join us and find a way there and, you know, just let's lead by example. You know, I just think it's wonderful what Mothers of Lost Children have done, California Protected Parents Association, the Courageous Kids, Karen and Connie, you both, you continue to go above and beyond every day. And this, in my mind, is what it's going to take. It's going to take all of us with the dedication and the level of commitment that you two ladies have to all of our children, not just your own, but all of us, screaming on their behalf. And then to really empower these heroes, these young heroes, to you know, speak up and share their courage with others. This is definitely what it's going to take. It's going to take all of us doing this. So I do hope, you know, May 9th through possibly the 11th, 10th, 11th,
12th? Through the 12th. Through the 12th.
Through the 12th to get some children to Washington, D.C. That would be wonderful.
And we can stay at the hostel. There's a youth hostel that's very inexpensive. And then some of the mothers open their homes to people staying there.
Wonderful.
So that those are places that we stay, the international hostel.
And now, what if there's any children listening right now and they wanted to get more information, would that be the same to for them to contact you through the CPPA001@AOL.com?
That they yes, because
kind
then
of follow
I
this?
Can, yes, and then I can put them in touch with the Courageous Kids Network.
Oh, wonderful. That would be wonderful. Stephen, are you there?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't want to leave you out. You haven't really said a whole lot, so I didn't know if you had any questions for Connie or Karen.
No, I'm okay. Are you going to go more, or is that about it, you think? Or?
Yes, yes, there's more. There's
there?
More
okay.
to say. Well, I'm not sure what time it is.
It's 9:30 Eastern.
Okay, so we have a few more minutes.
Sure.
Should we go till for another half hour?
If you want to.
Okay. I maybe this is a point to mention some pivotal news for youth. I've been following this with the United Nations that they were waiting for the 10th country to sign on to this optional protocol, which allows children themselves to appeal directly to the UN, children of any age. So this was just the United Nations Convention of the Rights of the Child was ratified in 1989 by every country, actually, except the United States and Somalia, I think. But the United States is one of the 10 countries that has ratified this optional protocol. So that's kind of interesting. But bottom line, what this United Nations Convention of the Rights of the Child optional protocol allows children to appeal directly to the UN when their rights have been violated in any way in their country. So this includes the possibility of parents on their behalf. If the child is not able to write their own, so that includes mothers like us, and or teachers, community leaders, friends of the children, or workers from agencies who can now sit down with the child and they can write, type, or dictate information that will trigger response, as they call it, in the halls of global power. So the young people that are not in this situation, that are out of it, they could be writing and they could be encouraging other young people to write. And if that kind of information got out to the youth, the students in schools, that's maybe a way that it could be picked up in a forum for the children in these situations. And we as mothers, I believe, can also write on our children's behalf because in these situations, they are not free to write on their own behalf and use their own words, their own things that they have said to us. So I'll find ways to post more of that information. That just came out today, so that's fairly groundbreaking because they were waiting for the 10th country to sign on to make that, possible. They needed 10 countries to sign on for this optional protocol.
Hey, Tanis?
Yes?
Somebody got a question in the chat there. It says, what happened to this Safe Child Coalition? I guess it's to Connie. Is Connie the one that left?
Hello?
Hello. Yeah, we're all here. What Safe Child Coalition through...
There was a question, what happened to the Safe Child Coalition?
Well, that's kind of a longish story. We had lobbied under the name of National... We've been working for many years to bring the various organizations throughout the country together to lobby as a united front at in Congress. So we kind of started in the mid-2000s. Developing the Safe Child Coalition, and then we called it the National Safe Child Coalition, and we created a platform to lobby Congress. Well, there was a person who, a volunteer, who was working on the website, and she took it in a completely different direction than we were wanting to.
So that's been a bit of an issue. But we're regrouping, and we're going to be working on another direction. But we've got Barry Goldstein has taken over the Safe Child Coalition, and this other person has taken the National Safe Child Coalition in a completely different direction. So the Safe Child Coalition will be moving forward under Barry Goldstein, and then we're going to unveil another lobbying group that will have to take the place of National Safe Child Coalition, because that has not focused only on family court, which is what we're only focused on is family court. So it's muddled. that's the end result. It's kind of muddled right now.
Okay.
I'd like to interject here that one of the things that all of these different groups and organizations and us trying to network through this and coordinate, what it actually reflects is the magnitude of this problem. All the different Facebook pages, personal pages, group pages on this issue, it just shows the research, the scholarly research that is out there, it shows that this problem is so big, and it's been for the large part unrecognized by society, by the general public, by the people in the system, because of that small percentage of these cases that go so bad and are so damaging to children. Barry Goldstein's research says 3.8% of the, is it custody or contested custody? 3.8%.
The 3.8 is trials, the ones that go to trial.
And so of that, they have these extreme outcomes. Now, it doesn't seem like a lot of kids, but overall, over 20-some years now that this has been going on in family courts, and given the number of divorces, that's hundreds of thousands of children. And like you said, in that other figure, the 58,000 children a year in the U.S. alone, that's 1 million children. Worldwide, that's a few million children. We're 1/10 the population in Canada, so if that statistic is fairly accurate, that's 5,000 children a year in Canada. And the other countries, UK, Australia, Europe, there's so many children being affected by this, but most people haven't heard of it unless they've walked through this fire or this war is happening in their lives and in their circle, like with their extended family, like the grandmothers are very affected by this, grandfathers, uncles and aunts that love the children. So it's still not something that is the public, the general public is aware of, because mainstream media hasn't covered it. And even though they say some of the family courts are public, they're really secret family courts. So the importance of all these organizations and the research and connecting with each other through forums like this, the internet radio, and we thank you, Stephen, for taking on this issue and hosting programs on this so other women can connect with each other and find out what is happening out there. And it may seem confusing, but really what it does reflect is the magnitude of this problem that isn't getting any better.
Exactly. We do have another question on here. Let's see, Connie and Karen, from Stacy Hart, she's asking, will you come speak at a Tim Donnelly event in Marin? I'm not sure where that is, but asking both of you to come speak at an event.
Would she like to just email me on that and give me more particulars?
That would be wonderful. So, Stacey, if you're listening, which I see you are, her email address is cppa001@aol.com. It's been in the, I put it in the chat room earlier, too. So that's wonderful. There's another question on here, too, from Intrinsic Lady. What if Courageous Kids did a campaign to the schools to give them information on what to do if the child needs help? To contact, the Courageous Kids Network,
And that's kind of what, you know, you guys were mentioning earlier, to really get this into the schools, because the children are so isolated and so alone that if they see something in their school, even a poster on the wall that has anything similar to their own life situation, it's going to attract their attention, and the, you know, they'll know that there's help out there. So it's a So the question is, what if Courageous Kids did a campaign to the schools to give them information on what to do if the child needs help?
So that would be sort of something that Jennifer Collins would probably, one could contact her through CourageousKids.net and say, what about this? This would be a great idea. Just fabulous.
Right, exactly. That would be wonderful. And it would get more kids together, even children in the schools, not particularly affected by something like this, that can speak up and stand out, you know, take a stand for those that are trapped in it. Because the children know, the ones that are close, you know, some of them, maybe they don't know the extent of it, of what they're suffering. But like in my son's situation, I know that their friends are very well aware. There's a reason their friends never visited with them when they went to their father's house, but always came over to our house. You know, so children, they gather, even children in the schools, not particularly affected by something like this, that can speak up and stand out, you know, take a stand for those that are trapped in it. Because the children know, the ones that are close.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That's a very
good point, and I was thinking the same too, Donna, because it could be the youth in the schools that are not directly affected that could change the legislation and start speaking out that children are not property. We're not property. We're not pieces of property. We're not possessions. We shouldn't be held under a custody order until we're 8, or no child should be held under a custody order until they're 18.
No. Children should, you know, in my opinion, the person to ask, it would be very simple. You ask the child where the child feels safest and where the child would want to invite a friend and feel safe with the friend there. And then put the child with that parent. That's easy.
That's right. It actually comes down to you're reminding me of something that I've said all along, Connie, is like, why is it not as simple as believing a child? If a child discloses abuse, they are telling the truth. And this is part of the problem. Maybe we should go back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show, was the myths that are being perpetuated, I think, through the Fathers' Rights initiatives and groups, that if a child discloses abuse, part of this myth is that they're never telling the truth. If it's a myth divorce, there's never, which is, the opposite is true. They're almost always telling the truth. In fact, research shows that only 2% may be false allegations. And the
right.
younger the child is, the more truthful they are, because they don't even know how to make this stuff up. And we could go into maybe mentioning a little bit, when children do disclose sexual abuse in particular, they don't say, oh, I was sexually abused or I was molested. They tell it in a child's way. And those that want to stamp out children's voices capitalize on is saying, oh, the mothers made that up. The mothers coached them.
Right.
If you could comment on that a little bit more.
Well, it serves a criminal well to impugn the witness, and that's what they're doing. It serves the criminal well. Our country is just beginning to move over from all the criminal rights, you know, which is understandable because people used to get put in jail all the time for nothing. But now it's moving a little bit more toward victims' rights. And there's this old-fashioned idea that children lie and women lie. I mean, it's a batterer's best weapon. And the good news is that in Congress, there's actually a whole group of people there called the Victims Caucus.
which means they're all people who are concerned about victims, not, you know, not the offenders. And we've been working with them a fair amount to try to get something going. Nothing has happened yet, but that's our sort of group that we're focused on, because they're focused on children and women, or children and victims, adult victims, who are trying to speak their truth and are being marginalized and shut down. But you're right. And one of the things I did was a little research on Child Protective Services outcomes of substantiation. It turns out that 15 years ago, about, you know, this is in one county in California, 25% of the cases that a child would come to CPS and say, "I'm being hurt," they would be substantiated. That means they were believed. Today, that number has dropped to 7% in my county. Only 7% of the kids are believed. So there's this huge drop. It's like, you know, they're disbelieved more and more and more and more by the Child Protective Services. Well, that happens in family court routinely. And the research that we've done, or I've read, I didn't do it, but somebody else did it, is that 30% of the children are protected if the parent is a batterer in family court. Only 10% of the children are protected if they reveal sexual abuse. Only 10% are protected. So really, they've got it completely backwards, because 10% of them are, you know, that's the group that should be. I mean, it's exactly the reverse of what it should be.
Yep. What this is, actually, you're talking about is gross negligence, which is a crime. When these people in positions of public trust, when the children are to tell the authorities, and the women mothers are told that this is the only show in town, you go here, you report it, you report suspicions of crime, criminal activity, concerns because your child disclosed abuse, and these people refuse to protect the children, and it's against the law for their mothers to. There is another catch-22. So really, when are these people going to be held accountable, since they want that power and authority to decide whether children are protected or not? I'm sure most of the women would just protect their own kids if they weren't made to, if they didn't have to force them to go where the child didn't feel safe or afraid, and they weren't forced into custody orders. The mothers would probably not rely on these services, but they are forced to rely on the legal system, the Child Protective Services, and the police. And so when they categorically fail these children, when are these people ever going to be held accountable? And maybe it's the youth that starts laying charges, that starts suing the child protective workers that didn't substantiate their truth. Maybe it's the youth that's going to be suing judges and police and CFS workers. Maybe that's where it's going to start, and saying, "You didn't believe me, and as a result, you aided and abetted crimes."
I don't know if I'm still on mute. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and that's a huge problem. The accountability is probably the biggest underlying problem of all of this. You know, that kids can't sue judges because they have judicial immunity. That's something that needs to be abolished, is that absolute judicial immunity. If kids were able to sue these judges that put them in dangerous places, you would see this change in a heartbeat. And that's
right.
What really needs to happen.
Well, in terms of...
And the other problem is, when you're talking about Child Protective Services and law enforcement, this mentality in the family court of disbelieving victims of abuse has so permeated... I mean, it started in family court, but it's permeated Child Protective Services and law enforcement, too. That's why there's such a huge problem, because it's, you know, mushroomed to the point where it's infected everything in the system.
That's right. And they can be charged. They can be sued. And maybe they'll start thinking about these children that come to them and report abuse so the judges don't get away with this. Because part of this setup, formula, whatever you want to call it, agenda, is the judges can say, well, CPS didn't substantiate it. Well, the police didn't charge. There was no criminal conviction. So therefore, there's nothing to the child's disclosures. But
that is an improper application of the burden of proof, because the burden of proof in family court is lesser than in dependency court or in criminal court. It's just their escape. That's all. It's a flimsy excuse for an escape.
That's exactly right. And then we've got, in addition, something we haven't talked about tonight is the parental alienation argument that's used to discredit women who believe their children and discount and nullify children's disclosures of abuse.
Well, and that's what's at the basis of all of this. It really is, that why we've gotten to this point. I remember talking to a woman who her daughters were molested by their father 30 years ago. And her children were removed from her custody by dependency court. And the dependency court judge sent her to counseling and then brought her before the court like 2 months later and said, I will return your children to you on one condition, that you do not ever let them have any contact with their father whatsoever until they're the age of majority. Now, that was 30 years ago. Now, all of a sudden, it's exactly the opposite. So, and that shift all came about because of this, you know, the underlying theory of parental alienation syndrome that got, you know, just kind of mushroomed into this, you know, mentality that's infected the whole system of disbelieving women and children.
Well, it's a pure agenda, and it's been well marketed, and I lost my train of thought, but it is an agenda, and it's all the judges are trained in it, the custody evaluators are trained to look for it, all the cottage industry mental health professionals are trained to address that. And going back to what you said earlier, an abuser's scary. And just like an adult woman is scared and walking on eggshells with an abuser, these children are scared. If they have a safe home and a safe parent, the last thing they want to be is with someone that they feel scared with. So then the mothers get labeled and castigated as parental alienators because the children don't want to be with that person that an adult wouldn't want to be with. In fact, that's often why these marriages end, because the mother, the woman, is going, no, this is too abusive. This is harmful and toxic. And so they don't want to be around their abuser. We understand that now in society, that women, adults, don't want to be around their abusers. Why would the child?
Right.
Right, exactly.
Well, and the child should have a voice, and that child, if the child says that's where they want to live and how they want to have the arrangement, custody arrangement, that should be honored unless there's a really strong reason not to. You know, that should be the default, what the child wants.
That's right. And listening to the child. What's so hard about believing a child? If a child discloses abuse, there's actually a major case, a trial going on right now in Vancouver, British Columbia, just north of you, and it's a 100-plus day trial. That mother has had a lawyer, Jack Hittrich, who has been fighting, I guess, to first of all, to get her children back because her children disclosed sexual abuse, and he was able to help her get her children back through family court. Now he, on her behalf and the children's behalf, is suing the Ministry of the Child and Family Services. It's been a 100-plus day trial, and he was interviewed by the CBC here in Canada saying that when young children disclose sexual abuse, they have to be believed. It's that simple.
Oh. Yeah. Unless you're a perpetrator, in which case you don't want it, the belief. So what it leads me to believe is there are an awful lot of perpetrators who are making these policies.
Exactly. Good point. I know myself, I've gone all the way up to the ranks in the state of Maine, and I have, at first I had great difficulty believing that there would be high-ranking officials involved in this, but at this point, after what I've seen and how far I've gone, I've taken this all the way to D.C. and the U.N., you said it. There's members up in the high-ranking official, you know, officials that want to keep this quiet, keep this silence, keep our children silenced, and keep them in prison. So I know we're coming down to the last few minutes of the show, ladies. I just wanted to give you, you know, an opportunity to kind of say anything else that you want to offer to, if there's any children out there listening tonight, just give you this moment now to kind of, anything else you want to add. Connie?
I think that I would like to end with never, ever give up hope, because good will win in the end.
So true. Amen. Amen. Wonderful. Karen?
I have to say, you know, the same thing, that you just can't give up. You can't give up because it's, you know, it's not even just you. It's all the kids that will come after you. And you can't give up for yourself or for them.
That's right. That's right. Always have hope. Know that we're all out here fighting and screaming for you. We all recognize how courageous each and every one of you are. The bravest heroes on this planet are our children, hands down. They are the ones I can't even imagine. You know, I ran from my ex-husband, but they're living with him. They're forced to live with him. So these children are the absolute heroes in my books. And I want to share the same sentiment that they never give up hope, and that, you know, we're going to do everything in our power to give them back their voices. We really are. I also want to share, before, you know, we end tonight, well, I want to say thank you, Connie, and thank you, Karen, for everything that you do for our children every single day. Thank you for setting up the Courageous Kids Network. That was a brilliant idea, and a great way to kind of get, you know, get the word to them that they're not alone. And thank you very much for coming on here tonight to our show.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah, you're welcome. And thank you to Stephen for hosting it.
Yes, yes.
Oh, yes. Hey, Donna.
Yes.
We need to recognize the two streams that we're on. We are on Scotland is Free stream over there in Scotland, and we are also on People's Internet Radio stream.
Oh, wonderful, and thank you so much to them and everyone that's listening in there. Stephen, like, you know, I can't thank you enough. Stephen has, you know, I know Connie and Karen, you're just meeting him tonight, but I met him a few months ago, Connie, just when I got back from Washington, D.C., and from the moment I met him, he's just done nothing but stepped up to the plate for all of our children and is doing everything he can to get this out into the public and raise public awareness and battle this, you know, child abuse on behalf of our children and give them a voice. So I do want to recognize Stephen. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Oh, you're welcome. And I want to talk to you and Tanis after we hang up on this call here. Can I call the two of you back then?
Yes, yep. And I have one more thing to add for anybody listening. Next week's show, we're going to have Charles Stecker Jr. on, and we're going to talk about his Turn Up the Volume tour, and it's going to be an incredible nationwide tour. So I just wanted to let everybody know ahead of time what's ahead in the show next week at this time. And thank you again, Connie and Karen. Tanis, did you have anything to add?
Yes, I would like to say that for the young people listening and for the moms and women in this to me is the civil rights movement of this century, of this time in our, this present time in the 2000. 50 years ago was marking the anniversary of the civil rights movement, where the segregation, the laws started to change. The blacks and whites weren't segregated anymore, and now we have women, mothers segregated from their children for their entire childhood, years. I don't know what greater civil rights issue this could be. Natural rights, civil rights, and so we are in the throes of this, and it took a couple decades to for that movement. So I'm hoping that there's a tipping point and that we are moving into liberation and that our children will be set free from these oppressive custody orders.
Well said, well said. I share in that sentiment, and amen. That's what we're going for. So thank you, everybody. Stephen, I'll let you take it from here.
Yes, this has been another Giving Children's Hope. So we will see everybody next Thursday at 8 Eastern here in America.